Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to the second episode of Chaos Theory. Joining me, bringing the chaos hammer, is the man himself, Michael Cao. Hi, mate. How are you doing?
Hello. So excited to do this.
Yeah, we've got another fantastic guest joining us. This discussion is, A, such an important one to be having right now, because there's just so much going on in the world. It's kind of crazy. But B, getting the chance to talk to these guys who have the kind of experience that our mutual friend Mike St. Pierre had the last time we spoke, and our upcoming guest today. It's just a fascinating window into a world that, you know, we finance guys, we kind of bumble around the fringes, and you've properly dipped your toes in, but the rest of us, we're trying to figure it out as we go along, and we're really just guessing at what's happening in the corridors of power. So what a great opportunity to have these conversations.
We have a very, very special guest today to help us bridge this gap, because our guest's name is Colonel Richard Lackament. And, you know, he has not only had an incredibly distinguished military career spanning over three decades, but when you look at his CV and his academic record and at the institutions that he has both risen up in and taught, he's now a professor at the U.S. Army War College, basically teaching essentially the geopolitics and the art of warfare, if you will, to our senior officer corps. I can't think of a better educator on this topic than Richard.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get Richard to flesh out that CV once he joins us in a moment. But mate, let me just ask you, obviously you've kind of found yourself pulled more and more into this world, you know, from a finance background, a finance perspective. How's it been for you being actually up close in a world that we've all speculated about, because we've kind of had to, it's part of our job, is to speculate about this stuff. How has it been for you making that transition to really actually understanding what goes on in that part of the puzzle?
I think understanding geopolitics now more than ever makes a big difference in trying to piece together one's macro view and understanding the potential tail risks, right? So as you know, I've a significant economic interest in an oil private equity that I've had for quite a long time, and that has forced me to follow the macro of oil very, very closely for over a decade now. And there's no more geopolitical commodity than oil. And it was also serendipitous. I think we might have talked about this in our debut episode, but the way I got into really the geopolitical angle was that a friend of mine, also a colonel, U.S. Army colonel, his name is Michael Hosey. I grew up with him, and about 2 years ago, he roped me into this national security seminar that's held by the U.S. Army War College. And it's a seminar that targets a couple of invited civilian guests to participate in these high-level discussions just about the world, about geopolitics. It was like a three-day seminar. And that really, really ignited my interest in this intersection that our podcast is now about. So that engagement in turn led to this unique opportunity that I had back in February to go present a paper at West Point. And then I met just a number of incredibly high-powered, real heavyweights in the field at West Point. And certainly Colonel Richard Lackament is one of them. He's probably one of the most impressive people that I've ever met.
And how did you find their kind of level of curiosity about the financial side of things? Because I think if you're in this business and you understand the way the monetary system works, you realize what an incredibly powerful weapon it is. And I've always kind of been curious as to whether the military establishment that doesn't understand it in the way we do looks on it the same way, or if it's because it's not kinetic, it's not cyber, it's not something that they're used to focusing on, whether they really understand how potent a weapon it is.
I really think that given China's methods at applying, quote, asymmetric warfare, especially using economic levers, I think the thinkers in our military halls have had no choice but to start really paying attention to the economic lever. And this is definitely a topic that we're going to want to explore with Richard today, because in our debut episode with Mike St. Pierre, we alluded to the DIME framework, right? The diplomatic, informational, military, and economic pillars of national power. And that's something that we're going to want to pick Richard's brain about.
Fantastic. Well, the timing is perfect because Richard is joining us now. So why don't we welcome him in?
Perfect.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you. Michael and I have been kind of rubbing our hands together at this chance to pick your brains for quite some time. We talked a little bit, or Michael introduced you before you joined us, but your career is such an extraordinary one. We thought we'd leave it to you to flesh that out, if you wouldn't mind, and give people a kind of understanding of your background.
Well, without knowing exactly what you all said, and thank you for the very kind words. I'm thrilled to join you all. I've really enjoyed my conversations with Michael, who's really got a fascinating mind. Great to meet him in person at West Point, but we had a common friend that obviously he's known for years, and I can understand why they're good friends, given what a strong military officer Michael Hosey is. And just what an incredible community in the way these interesting connections arise. I'm really a creature of the Army in many different regards. I was actually born in an Army hospital in Germany, was an Army brat growing up in several military posts, including all 4 years of high school in Europe and Belgium and Italy. And my dad was not a West Pointer, but when I kind of expressed interest in being an Army officer because I thought the life was fascinating and important, he encouraged me to consider West Point. And I did, and I ended up going to the United States Military Academy. And after graduating, I was a field artillery officer for 18 years before being a strategist for the last 11 plus years of my career. And then I retired really to be kind of a full-time professional military education academic. So I'm really first and foremost really a military and Army professional. And I've done that obviously in some form or fashion most of my life, and done it full-time as a professional military educator since 2011. But on active duty, I was with the 82nd Airborne Division, the 101st Airborne Division, the 1st Armored Division, and other units over time. I spent time in Desert Storm with the 1st Armored Division in 1990-91, in Iraq again with the 101st Airborne Division in 2003, and then Afghanistan most heavily from 2010 to 11, assigned to the headquarters there, actually lent by the Army War College to go back out to the field to work there. But in addition to my sort of more typical sort of artillery and strategist career, I also had some time in academia, teaching at West Point for 3 years, teaching at the Naval War College for 3 years, and then 2 years at the Army War College, all of that on active duty before I retired to do it full-time since. In addition to my sort of deployments and my academic time, I also spent a fair amount of time working strategic level issues in the Pentagon, at the Office of Secretary of Defense for Policy, in our Human Resources Command on talent management, and as Chief of Plans in Korea. So I guess those are probably the main highlights I would throw out there. But although I work for the Army War College, there's a standard disclaimer that all the views that I'm expressing are my own and not necessarily those of the U.S. government, the U.S. Army, or the Army War College. Otherwise, I'm entitled to academic freedom as a professor, even in the military system. I have to accurately state U.S. policy, and I can critique it if I wish, but I can't misstate it, and I can't tell you anything classified.
Fantastic. I can see Michael champing at the bit, but I want to sneak one quick question if I can before I turn Michael loose on you. I'm curious because I think for those of us outside the military, we think of kind of warfare in two paradigms. There was the warfare that we all saw on TV, the Second World War, and then modern warfare. But I'm curious to know, for someone who was engaged in Desert Storm back in the early 90s, and then 2010 in Afghanistan. In that 20-year period, how has the nature of warfare on the ground changed for those of us that get all our information from movies?
And I'll rephrase it slightly in terms of I'm one of these, and it's kind of a very Clausewitzian notion that sort of the nature of war is pretty stable across millennia. That is the character of war that tends to change. But even there, I think there's the nature of war element is that humans have found it incredibly useful to employ violence to get their ways. That's primordial. But if you look at sort of what goes on, why we care so much, is violence is extremely useful. If you can dominate and dictate, you don't have to, deal with their intellectual abilities or different, complex arguments. So in that regard, they're both very much of a piece. Very passionate participants who want their way are willing to use violence, and they try to do it in the best way they can. There is kind of the conventional World War II version of kind of what looked like Desert Storm. That's kind of what we say is normal or traditional or conventional war. But frankly, I got to Desert Storm after having been in the 82nd Airborne Division for 4 years, where we spent most of our time thinking about all the odds and ends of ways violence could be used that included conventional war, but included insurgencies, counterinsurgencies, stabilization. And I think those elements have always been there. And to the degree that those are harder and less glorious, the military, and I'll say that straight up, the U.S. Army, my dad was a Vietnam vet, and I was mindful of the problems in Vietnam, even as I was studying at West Point, sort of came back to haunt us in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they never really went away. Human beings are incredibly innovative and adaptive when it comes to getting their way. And when violence is available, they're going to look for the best ways to use it. I have a friend whose statement was, there's two ways to do strategy, asymmetric and stupid. If you look at somebody's strengths and you decide you're going to take them on head on, that's usually not a good path forward. Usually most strategy is to try to find your enemy's weaknesses and employ your strengths and try to get your way in the best way, most economical, most thoughtful way possible. In that regard, both are similar. And I think we, and I say this is we, U.S. military in particular, but allies as well, sort of prefer a certain way of warfare, which is to our advantage, that sort of conventional capability that we won World War II with at the high level, did well with Desert Storm. But we've always sort of been challenged at that more complicated level where people are using violence that's not easily dealt with by conventional means. And in that regard, I think we turned a blind eye to that, and that I worry that we might do that again after Afghanistan. This is not about technology. The Taliban certainly didn't out-technology us. They out-committed us to the thing. And that's not uncommon in world history. So looking at the moral dimensions, the sort of motivational dimensions of why people use violence and are willing to give their lives, that's common to all wars. The question is how you square what you're trying to accomplish for your country, your military, your people against some adversary who wants to confront you. It's interactive. And so being mindful of how to interact in both forms. Sorry, that's kind of a long answer, but you know, the warfare, I think, is very similar themes. And being prepared for how much do you care and how much are you willing to do? And can you deal with each of the different ways violence can be used? And that just gets more complicated over time.
This first topic that you and Grant just kicked off in terms of frameworks of warfare, I think I want to just pull on that thread for a little bit and maybe talk about, you know, the Clausewitz framework that I know that the War College teaches. And there's also this Sun Tzu framework that I'm sure is very prevalent in China. And I'm sure it's an oversimplification, but do you think you could explain perhaps the two different methodologies? You referred to asymmetric warfare and the strategic deception. Those tend to be associated with the Sun Tzu art of war tactics. And you certainly see China employing a lot of those tactics, especially in the economic realm, where because we have a free market society, perhaps we're more challenged to outflank them on that front. But then there's also this Clausewitzian framework where you consider warfare to be an extension of politics, and we emphasize overwhelming force as we've seen in our engagements in the Middle East. I'm curious how you view those two frameworks, and is it an oversimplification to say that we in the West tend to be more Clausewitzian and the East tends to be more Sun Tzu?
In general, I'd probably say yes. I think it is an oversimplification that I see both Clausewitz and Sun Tzu as complementary. Routinely, we study them both at the sort of the war college levels. And probably the main difference I would articulate between the two is I think both of them are trying to understand war in their times. And Clausewitz is really trying to figure out the massive revolutionary impact of the Napoleonic Wars, which had very little to do with technology. Most militaries were carrying the same equipment. But what Napoleon had tapped into was essentially a societal mobilization. He could build bigger militaries of more committed people because of what they were fighting for, which is kind of why Clausewitz identifies it's not just a technical solution. It really is the passion of the will, you know, imposing your will on others and motivating people for something that sort of made war so dramatically different than sort of the monarch-led armies of the previous century in Europe. Sun Tzu is kind of looking at the Warring States period in China, where different groups of Chinese fighting each other. So there's a sense of you're really not, you know, it's sort of an internal, it's not civil war per se, but it's the idea that the sense of trying to capture what you can, because they're going to be part of the Chinese entity that you're creating, leads to a little bit different dynamic, certainly at that time. It's still violent and vicious warfare, you really look at what happens in that time frame, but the sense of what you're trying to do to co-opt others. And I think there Sun Tzu does a better job than Clausewitz is sort of looking beyond the actual violence of battle to war and for getting your way with deception, with diplomacy, with intelligence, and a variety of other things that are still war, but maybe less focused on the violence, hence winning without fighting is the acme of success. But both are very clear on war as something a state does. Literally the first line of Sun Tzu is the understanding of the nature of war is vital to the importance of the state. It's basically a life and death thing that you have to be mindful of. And both spend time sort of articulating ways to achieve the state's ends and in different contexts. But I think if there is, and there's also kind of an Indian theorist, Kautilya, out of the Indian subcontinent, who's an even sort of more vicious and, in Western terms, more Machiavellian view of how to get your way and use whatever means possible. And it's a little bit probably less constrained and vicious and less moral, fewer moral boundaries. But I think in all three cases, what you see is it's about how violence needs to be understood, employed if need be, thwarted, most importantly, so that a state can do what it thinks it needs to do, a ruler or a people. And I think that's where they differ too, that a lot of this has to do with, you know, how do you articulate the entity? So I think Clausewitz is theoretically incredibly sound. It's a practitioner who's identified kind of war's key things. And I think the basic theory of war that he lays out is more profound and accurate than Sun Tzu's. It's not clear what Sun Tzu's theory of war is. He's more about how to fight it and get your way. So it's more instrumental to the ruler and the commander. I mean, all of them do a version of this, but I think Clausewitz nails the theoretical elements in a more profound and general way and is not limited to a European mindset. Mao Zedong was very familiar with Clausewitz and often mouthed many of the same principles that he had gained from Clausewitzian insight. Although if his sense was you wanted to behave, particularly in the Chinese Civil War, in a more Sun Tzuian manner, to win without fighting. So I don't know, that's kind of a long way that I think they're complementary, but they each have interesting insights that are worth individual study and thought.
When we talk about asymmetric warfare, though, I'm curious what dimensions you see the Chinese in particular employing these asymmetric warfare strategies. I certainly think in the economic realm, it's pretty obvious to me, but I'm curious where else you see it employed.
Well, again, my sense is that most good strategy is asymmetric, and partly it's like where we tend to overstate, and this has been if I were to look at the United States as a strong power, and let me contrast that with the United States as a weak power. One of my favorite wars to study for strategy and policy is the American Revolution, essentially where the United States, George Washington and the Continental Congress and the Continental Army are confronting the superpower of the era that undertakes the world's largest amphibious operation ever to that moment to send 30,000 troops to the United States in 1776. And they're incredibly capable militarily. And Washington knows better than to fight them head up, one-to-one. He tries certain things. He needs to confront them. He does fight some battles, but he picks very carefully after some major disasters, just as a note. So he actually gets it wrong. But if you've ever studied like the 10 days between December of 1776, essentially the Washington's crossing, the Battle of Trenton, the retreat back to Pennsylvania, then the second Battle of Trenton, and then the Battle of Princeton, you realize he's used his undersized force to pick off two garrisons to get battle victories that were incredibly strategically important. And it drove the British back in on their garrisons in a way that undermined all the British gains of 1776 from July to like the end of December when they had conquered most of New Jersey. You know, when you realize that, yes, when you have the advantages, you try to play to them. And the British tried to do that in the American Revolution. We've tried to do that. And yet there are ways to counter those that I think, and then you could say crudely Sun Tzuian, maybe Clausewitz does tend to focus more on the clashes of competent nation states with large militaries, which really did have a major impact on the way the Napoleonic Wars played out. But he still has the same sort of sense of how to, so he doesn't emphasize the asymmetries as much as Sun Tzu does, but they're still trying to get at the magnitude of the effort and the value of the object is a Clausewitzian phrase. So it's like, what do you do? How do you much should you commit based on what you're trying to accomplish? Sun Tzu just, I think, has kind of a more poetic, more interesting sort of approach to it. So yes, I would say Sun Tzu does a little better job at emphasizing how to approach things asymmetrically than Clausewitz does, maybe. But I think at core, they both sort of get at those themes, but Sun Tzu does it better.
So this theme, though, of playing to one's strengths came up in the U.S.-China event in which you participated that I chaired. So Grant, in May, I hosted this U.S.-China event, and Richard was one of the distinguished panelists to debate various topics. And I think one of the topics that came up was that, Peter Zeihan gave the keynote. And, you know, we all know Peter's views, you know, essentially that China has all of these, you know, geographic and strategic vulnerabilities. And, you know, if push came to shove, we could potentially cut them off at the knees. But one of the panelists brought up, I really love this metaphor that, you know, be careful not to be the taxi company comparing the size of its car fleet when facing the Uber threat. And so this notion, and Richard, you and I have talked about offset strategy. So China is certainly focused on these offset strategies on how best to counter our strengths. For instance, their missile capabilities against our supercarriers. I'm curious how you view the state of our military versus China's as far as these, you know, offset strategies, and how effective is China at playing to its strengths and being able to offset our strengths?
Yeah. One, China is, I think, the most daunting security threat that we can think of. And I'd say that if I were to focus on the military part in particular, I think we've got to take them incredibly seriously. But one of the flip sides of offsets is it's usually because there's a weakness. In other words, if you're trying to offset, trying to figure out a way to offset an adversary's strength, sometimes it's also a reflection of what you know your weakness or your concern is. Some of our offsets were offsetting Soviet conventional power in the early Cold War era by essentially leaning on nuclear weapons. In other words, we had a nuclear weapons advantage that we thought would allow us to not overinvest in conventional forces, which we thought would dislocate our economy, dislocate our whole society to stay essentially mobilized in the same way that we had been during World War II. We wanted that anomaly of war mobilization to go away. We think that's unnatural to a healthy democratic society. So we didn't want to maintain the equivalent to the Red Army, because the Red Army stayed heavily mobilized after the war. So our offset was nukes. And then when they sort of gained parity with nukes, our offset became precision. And so our view that, well, we won't build artillery, what we need to match them conventionally, but rather than try to go cannon for cannon, howitzer for howitzer, tank for tank, we went for sort of precision and what we call air land battle, working closely with the Air Force to offset them. And that was kind of what you saw during Desert Storm, what on paper looked like very evenly equipped forces. In fact, the Iraqis technically had more of most categories of weapons than we did, were no match for the precision weaponry and the system of targeting and attack that we had built in the latter half of the Cold War. So for the Chinese, the sense that if their model for many years had been sort of a mass peasant army that was very inefficient at certain things, not particularly high tech, but could overwhelm you. Think Korea, where the loss ratios were incredibly bad, 10-1 losses by the Chinese compared, I say the Chinese, meaning the People's Volunteer Army, which was a fig leaf for the actual PLA being engaged on North Korea's behalf. And they had some successes overwhelming US formations. But eventually we sort of countered that and we got to a stalemate in Korea. And that stalemate's a win for the Chinese as they see it, because we were so much more advanced as they saw it. But if that was kind of their model for many years, the sense that that was never really good against us in a military context. So what's their offset going to be? I think they're trying to come up with a high-tech offset. So they, one, it's sort of, yes, it does sort of confront our, meaning US and our allies, specific strengths in sort of high-tech precision weaponry, which if you think about the second offset to the Soviets that sort of ended the Cold War, was kind of what the Chinese thought they had to deal with. They're trying to figure out how to offset that technological capability with their own, but it's also, they can't really rely on their old one. The sort of mass troops, conscription forces doesn't really get you there. And they're not reliable. They don't build the junior officers. They don't build the junior NCOs. Not saying they're not working on it, but that's a harder lift. And when you look at the virtues of the US and allied militaries, oftentimes it has kind of a democratic underpinning. We trust our people to do the right thing because they've been given guidance and they are educated, intelligent, and committed, and can operate independently in ways that authoritarian military forces have a really difficult time doing, particularly if it's countercultural. My sense is that's very countercultural to the Chinese. They're trying to skip it. If they could do it all with push-button warfare from a couple of command centers on mainland China, and they don't have to rely on a lot of individual initiative by junior officers and junior NCOs and soldiers and sailors and so on and so forth, that's what they're going to try to offset their weakness in that area. And they have a focus thing. You know, the idea that Taiwan is a focal point versus we're global.
That's a great point.
Yeah. So the idea that they are mindful that there's an asymmetry in interest and focus of our armed forces. But at the same time, I think their vulnerability in terms of how long can a conflict go on before adaptability and reliance on junior members of the military becomes more important. Look at the Ukraine-Russia thing. If there's assumption that we can do this very quickly, and so the adaptation part doesn't occur, we just win with our first plan. That's usually not the way important or wars for valuable stakes work. Usually they get drawn out because you don't really knock them out and they still care. They'll keep pursuing it. And then the question is, can you adapt? Can you deal with the long-term elements of that? And I think most militaries try to avoid that, period. Everybody wants a quick, decisive victory, but most wars don't actually resolve that way. And so the question is, how do you adapt? How do you sustain? How do you deal with attrition? How do you deal with all the things that come with a prolonged or a protracted war? By the way, Sun Tzu says, never get involved in a protracted war. But the flip side is, if you want to make it tough for your adversary, make the war protracted. That was part of the insight.
Well, it's interesting that I actually started rereading The Art of War in preparation for our talk today. And I actually meant to ask you about that, because in relation to Taiwan, and you know, obviously everybody's wargaming all of these scenarios from blockades, amphibious assaults. When you read Sun Tzu, one of the key stipulations is do not do a protracted siege, which I would think China would be. But there's also disagreement on that front. And I think, you know, one of the takeaways from the May event that you and I participated in was that there seemed to be this agreement, at least amongst all of you panelists, that China would want to avoid a protracted showdown in any case. But what's the risk of a sort of fait accompli, lightning strike, quick takeover scenario? And then what's the risk of what I call the gray rhino bloodless coup scenario, right? That's why I worry about that, because that's one scenario where I can see, well, you know, it becomes politically untenable for us to intervene in a bloodless coup situation. And all of a sudden, boom, it's already done. And if it really takes us potentially a month and a half to deploy our carrier strike force to the region, then is it too late?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's one of those fascinating questions of history, because there's many of these examples where the assumption that a fait accompli will work, and I can think of many different contexts that were many different examples. For example, the idea of like the most obvious one recently is the sense of the Russians thinking that they could just knock Ukraine out. And even some of the interesting reads on what non-Ukrainian analysts thought suggest that there was a fair amount of sense that maybe the Russians could well do that. And so look at it, a lot of the sense of protraction, the first stages were going to have to show that the Ukrainians were really dedicated to their own defense. I think there's a similar version of that, that if there's not others there on the ground and there weren't in Ukraine, for example, who are going to, you know, be the shield. They're not part of NATO. They don't have Western troops or others there. It was going to be up to the Ukrainians to demonstrate some level of resolve before others would have time to act and respond. I think there's a sense that, you know, Taiwan may be in a similar one. So that leaves a window open that, so if the Chinese think, the PRC thinks, that they can somehow preclude through whatever means, a bloodless coup, a very quick event that delivers a fait accompli, then what? And I think it's a fascinating notion to consider. But I would put back to the sort of Chinese and anybody who's thinking these things is, humans have demonstrated amazing resilience when they care about something. And to do the sorts of things, in other words, to resist. And so to assume that you're going to find the method that will preclude any resistance, I think history says that's a pretty dangerous bet to make, that most human beings confronted with major stakes, even if they don't necessarily fight right away, we'll try to figure out how to get their way. And if violence is part of that, they'll do it. So I would hope the Chinese take pause One from history more broadly, but what you've seen in Ukraine, what we've seen throughout in terms of what are they asking them to do? If they're asking a bloodless coup where they're just simply asking them to make a minor change in their governing structure, well, if the Chinese PRC softens and the Taiwanese think, oh, we can be a regular province of China, who are we to stop them from agreeing that realizing one China in the way they've asserted it should be for many years could work? But if the Taiwanese are not inclined to do that, like say Hong Kong was a bad model, we don't want to go along, how does the PRC convince them to do that? That's the bigger question. So could it be bloodless? Maybe. The circumstances right now don't suggest that that's in the cards.
I'm just curious, when you have these discussions, obviously the task before the military commanders and the strategists is very straightforward in terms of there's an objective we're trying to reach here. But how much time and how big a counterbalance is it managing public perception of these strategies, these plans? Because obviously, when we got to Desert Storm in 91, there had been 16 years since the end of Vietnam. And yet, since Desert Storm, there's a sense, certainly here in the UK, I know at the time I spent in America, that it kind of all melds into one and it's just this cycle of war that's going on and that gets wearing for the public. So how much time is spent trying to figure out, almost, we realize we have to do this, how do we sell this to the public and get the buy-in?
It's a great question. And in terms of how do we sell this to the public is a...
That's a flippant way of putting it. It's just the best words I could find.
Well, I get that. In terms of, I think I would probably rephrase it a little bit in terms of how to understand what the stakes are for the public. You know, my favorite construct of war is explicitly Clausewitzian. It's what he called the trinity of wars. War is a remarkable trinity. It's comprised of passion, enmity, and primordial violence. I'm not kidding. This is not an exact quote. The creativity and chance, and then it's an element directed towards reason. That's the trinity. Now, in the very next paragraph, he goes on to say something about passion and primordial violence and sort of enmity tends to be a character of the population. The element of chance and creativity belongs to the army and the commander, and reason belongs to the government alone. Some people will call that the government, people, army, sub-trinity, but the real trinity was that war has to consider the passions of the people. You may have something you want, but if you're going to use violence to do it, you have an army and a commander with some creativity and ability. Nonetheless, at some level, the most important part was really, how much does it matter? And what's that passion? And my sense is that's where the will of the people is always the strategic center of gravity. If the people don't care enough, they're not going to commit to it. If they do, they can do incredibly dramatic things. The air power theory between World War I and II was fascinating for its abstractions and its assumptions about what populations would do. The idea, we'll bomb populations and they'll be terrified and they'll give up. And then we spent the war terror bombing every country that was a major belligerent with the caveat that nuclear weapons may, and there's a lot of debate about it, how much if it was just nuclear weapons alone for two cities in August 1945 was sufficient to tip the Japanese to surrender, given all the other horrific things that were happening to them, to include Soviet stuff. But sort of that idea of how do you gauge that? But that's really more the government's job. It's the, you know, who makes the decision that we're going to invest these things on, or we're going to make these efforts on behalf of our people, and the people have a say, and the people are unpredictable. Look at support for wars over time, you know, all the sort of rally around the flag up front that tends to drop off for a variety of reasons. And the question of how well does the entity responsible for reason in guiding violence in war, how well that's done. I think that's an area where the military is not they shouldn't be judging that. They can sense what the costs are and how it is to motivate their own people. Part of the primordial violence, enmity, and passion adheres to the army itself. What do you fight for? You know, how well does the Wehrmacht fight versus the U.S. Army and the British Army in World War II? It has something to do with what they think they're fighting for. Sorry, I got a little bit off track.
It's so interesting because it occurred to me that very basic nature of warfare just has not changed through the millennia. I recently read the biography of Alexander the Great. I annotated the whole thing and I was following it by like a map, every little part of the campaign. And I found it interesting because in the very beginning of his campaign, as he moves from Macedon down the Mediterranean coast, passion, right? I mean, his army was just fired up. But by the time he's 10 years in and he's made it to the Hindu Kush and he wants to convince his army to go into India, the army had lost the passion and he actually was forced to turn around. There's a thread in this Alexander the Great story that I wanted to pull on, which you alluded to earlier, which is this notion of staying power and logistical support. Now, I found it fascinating that one of the keys to Alexander's success was that he traveled with his corps of engineers, and he was always able to figure out how to deal with very logistical challenges to enable his element of surprise. And at our US-China event, I believe you had mentioned that in World War II, the Germans and the Japanese had tremendous frontline capabilities, but they lacked logistical support and staying power compared to the US. I wonder how you would characterize how the US is now positioned against China in that regard.
Well, at some level, I mean, it is one of our strengths that is probably less appreciated by others. The reason we have the forces we do around the globe is one of the things we talk about in terms of setting a theater. We have an incredible ability to build infrastructure. We partly learned it during World War II at its highest level. And then what you hinted at is the idea of fighting Germany and Japan on their home fields, which we did with, a lot of support from allies, don't get me wrong, but overwhelmingly with an industrial base centered on North America. So the idea that we fought an away game of incredible complexity with literally tens of millions of soldiers, or we had, I think our max was 12 to 16 million at any given moment, but fighting against the Japanese, the Germans, fighting with others. And we were also Lend-Lease supplying the Soviets, Lend-Lease supplying the British. We were kind of the arsenal of democracy. So that incredible logistics system to set those theaters, which in part set the conditions. So if you think of a lot of the international order of today, a lot of it is a creation of the immediate post-World War II era. Some of it also militarily reflects the logistical footprint we laid across the globe throughout the Pacific. You and I were talking about Guam, for example, and what Guam represents now, which was a territory we acquired pre-World War II, but the Japanese took it from us, we took it back. And a lot of those islands and areas that we use in the Pacific provide a theater structure that gives us great benefits. And we've done that in Europe. We've done that. And again, a lot of this relies on allies. This is not an empire that the Americans command. This is an alliance structure of countries that work with us and have very similar views and support us that have given us an incredible logistic footprint. But when you look at something like, and we've talked about, like something in Taiwan, that's still, it's only 100 miles. Granted, 100 miles across water is incredibly daunting. It was, Normandy was at 20 miles, was incredibly difficult to pull off, asking that the Chinese kind of realize that you're trying to cross that water. But nonetheless, their logistical structure is, they're on their home field. They're a little bit closer to home. They can rely on mainland China. That's one of our strengths, is that we have that system and it is supported by other countries who reflect our values. So it's not just that we have a military capability. What's underlying it is a sense of shared values. That's why the Japanese, why the Koreans, why the Philippines, why Australians, why Europeans, Lithuanians, all the Baltic states, why all those countries sort of allow this structure to exist the way it does, which again should give the Chinese pause about who is on their side when push comes to shove versus why do we have that structure that they continually attack.
Well, your two-word question, then what, even in the case of a bloodless coup, I think is a very provocative one, because even if that happened, you would think that our entire alliance structure within the Indo-PAC would not be okay with, for instance, a PRC-controlled TSMC. So then what? It's our job to make sure that China considers the then what, right?
You're exactly right. I mean, the then what part really kind of gets to how committed, for example, and this is what the Chinese and the Russians talk about a fair amount, or implicitly or explicitly, they try to raise that. How much are the United States really committed and vice versa? How much should the allies that we have be committed to that relationship? Can they trust us? The classic sort of nuclear umbrella one is, will we trade Paris for New York? Would we actually use nuclear weapons to protect Seoul from nuclear attack from somewhere else? And I think the same thing goes that if we don't act to support Taiwan, what's the potential next domino? Would we not support South Korea? Will we not support Japan? Will we not support the Philippines? The sort of the sense of there's a domino sounds too strong a term. What we've, I think that's a, should be a fairly discredited term.
Well, it's a slippery slope. If not it, a domino, a slippery slope.
But the sense that each of those has their own dynamics, I would tend to assert that certainly don't want Taiwan to fall. There's a lot of reasons why we wouldn't acquiesce. Even a bloodless revolution or bloodless coup or whatever you want to call it would be problematic at many different levels. And a lot of it's going to be context, contingent, dependent. But I would think the relationship with South Korea, the relationship with Australia, the relationship with Japan and others are independent of those in ways that are very profound and thick. I would hope at this point that that, you know, I'm not sure Taiwan knocks all the dominoes over automatically. And I think it would be folly for the Chinese to think that's the case. We were probably wrong to think that was the case in other contexts. And I think it would be folly for them to see that too. So we would not, on principle, you know, we certainly don't want Taiwan to fall. We support their self-determination, their democratic values, their independence, and there's the structure they have built that is very effective at many different levels. I don't think we'd ever endorse that, just like we don't endorse what's happened to Hong Kong. We don't endorse Tibet. We don't endorse Xinjiang. We don't endorse those sorts of things where the Chinese have already been heavy-handed. Even if they were somehow to accomplish control over Taiwan, if they do it in a manner that we find inappropriate, immoral, unethical, however you want to characterize it, whether we would fight in the absence of an actual military provocation or something more, again, that's going to be probably the context and specifics will be very important, but I'm not sure how quickly or how dramatically they necessarily affect our other allies and partners and relationships.
Richard, I know we want to talk to you about the dime framework, but before we get to that, I'm curious, is there a point where the alliances you talk about, and it's such a fascinating exercise to think of this, as you say, not an empire, but a series of alliances. But is there a point where in a world that's becoming more confrontational, the number of those alliances as opposed to the strength becomes problematic rather than a tailwind?
My gut reaction is no, they're a strength of the United States system, is that the alliances are all mutual alliances. Then some are, you know, a little bit disproportionate. Our alliance was to defend Japan. Theirs is not to defend us, for example. NATO is a very much a reciprocal alliance. But no, that I think is ultimately one of our strengths. And so I tend to see, you know, adding Sweden, maybe eventually adding Ukraine, things like that as a positive thing. And the Chinese, I think, rightfully keep sending us a signal that if focusing on that relationship, that we're exactly correct. They attack our alliances relentlessly because they know that that's our strength.
That's the salami slicing approach, right?
Right. And to the degree that China, given their power, and this is their history too, one-on-one, China with any other power tends to win and get their way. They're just too important, too big, too powerful, too influential, particularly like on economic and some other things, that they get deference in a variety of different ways that I think is crudely sort of historically sort of baked into their DNA when they think diplomacy and dealing with the outside world. Don't make that overly deterministic, but the sense that there's sort of habits of when you have all that power, you use it to your advantage. And one of the ways is isolate weaker powers one-on-one. It's hard for them to do that when other powers are tied to us. And that's kind of, because that's their main thing, is to try to break those ties or weaken those ties. Because if they can take them on one-on-one, they kind of know the way that's going to play out. And don't get me wrong, those partners in those regions, they don't want to choose between us security-wise and China economically. And they constantly tell us that. So even our closest allies, formal treaty allies, but even more so from like partners like ASEAN, weren't necessarily formal security allies, kind of see us as valuable to checking the Chinese security-wise, but aren't inclined to be forced to choose economically. And even the Americans don't want to choose economically, you know, binary, yes, China, no China. We want relations with China that are healthier, but we don't tend to talk about cutting ourselves off and doing what, you know, we did kind of with the Soviet sphere. But no, I guess that's a long way of saying, I think the allies are very, very important security-wise and their mutual agreements. If there is a element of that that I would endorse in terms of the burden, there is a domestic policy question, I think, in the United States that certainly bubbled up in ways, if you see sort of responses to how much do we continue to give or support Ukraine. There is a sort of an isolationist faction that had been mostly pushed to the margins after World War II. I mean, it was there very strongly most of American history until 1939, 1941, frankly. The question is that reemerging in a significant fashion that affects American domestic politics, that Americans feel that burden in ways that we have tended not to since World War II. That's probably more significant. And this, so I'm just saying as a strategist, I tend to see it as a strength in terms of how the United States operates. But there is a domestic tension that's opening that's different than anything I've lived through or really have seen analyzing the post-World War II era.
Before we go to Dime, because I think that is a topic we want to talk about, I do have one last question that kind of ties this whole issue of logistical support and offset strategy. And that is the way I think of our relative strengths and weaknesses vis-a-vis China are, well, number one, geographically, we have tremendous advantages, right? We essentially have an impregnable homeland with oceanic buffers and friendly buffer states and all this arable land. And we have natural resources in terms of oil, food. And China is essentially short those. But their offsets have been to neuter our geographic advantages. Their offsets have primarily been pursuing cyber, space, and economic warfare. And then another one of our strengths is our blue water force projection capability of our Navy. And I often say that the Chinese Navy tends to have green water superiority where they can control the first island chain, but they really can't force project out like our Navy can. But their offset strategy there has been hypersonics. But also one of the things that I think I find kind of alarming is that Kyle Bass, for instance, recently gave a talk at the Hudson Institute where he talked about how China's hoarding 70% of the world's grain supplies. We all know that China has been building up its oil SPR, even as we've been gutting ours. So I guess the question is, one, at the highest levels, I hope our military is paying attention to this, but how come we are allowing things like gutting the SPR to happen when it seems to be blatantly obvious that China is really, really girding up for what looks like what they think could be, you know, I think President Xi has couched it as stormy seas, right? A potential protracted conflict. And are we leaving ourselves, our flank exposed despite all these innate advantages that we have?
Now, good question. And as I look at it, I mean, part of it is Americans, and I say this in a very broad terms, and it includes the military, tend to be spoiled. And we don't sometimes realize how many benefits we have that we just take for granted. You pointed out the key ones, sort of geography, arable land, sort of the sweet spot of we're self-sufficient in ways that most countries in the world are not. And I say that in sort of about the most important things. One of the observations that I would have over the last few decades, to the degree we perceived ourselves vulnerable, personally vulnerable, the United States itself vulnerable to oil supplies, I think is a fascinating thing. And you're more of an expert in this than I am in terms of why were we in the Middle East the ways we were? Why did the Gulf War matter? Why were we guarding Kuwaiti tankers during the Iraq-Iran War? Why were we doing some of these things that suggested a real concern about the vulnerability of the United States to oil dependence? This is the post 73, 79. How vulnerable are we? It's fascinating for me to watch that we mentally, and this is an observation across communities, broad generalization, the whole thing with shale and fracking and all that, that we've realized we're back to being the world's number one oil producer again. I'm not sure that's accurate right this moment, but I mean, at one point we were sort of, are we still are,
but I would say that it's given us a false sense of security because that is a finite resource that is a high decline resource. The folks that extrapolate this shale miracle and assume that we can do that again, I think are going to be sorely mistaken. And so that's one of my long-term concerns and also why I'm long-term bullish on oil, even though short-term, I think it faces headwinds.
But I guess if I were to put it in the crude sort of military geostrategic mind, like what are the sorts of things that can determine even protracted wars? My sense is quick, decisive victories are what everybody wants, and those are rare, and that's aspirational and desirable. But usually it takes a country that can actually weather pretty difficult storms for a period of time. And we've been blessed in that sort of our basic ability to provide our needs. And I'd start with the number one need any society has is feed. Food, shelter, and clothing are the most important basic needs. We got a good climate. we can grow our own food, we can feed ourselves, we can take care of ourselves, and we can, and with disruptions and pain, meet our energy needs. My sense is that what you described earlier on is the Chinese know that they're vulnerable. And if the number one vulnerability of a society confronting war has had to deal with, it's usually food. And if you read about historical wars, notice how many times food and starvation are central to what's going on. I mean, sieges are usually about starving out a group that has a military defensible position that you then try to starve them into submission. And it works. Same thing with societies. Germany was essentially defeated by starvation in World War I, probably more than anything else. And there's all sorts of things going on, but it's the reason they're still in France when they surrender. Their country is imploding while they're starving, crudely. I mean, again, these are massive oversimplifications. And so leading up to World War II, it was interesting to watch, if you read sort of the background, how much the major societies inoculated themselves against starvation up front. And were really, that was one of their major concerns, was how not to starve, because that's when your population and its will to fight collapses. If you can't eat, you don't fight. And so starvation is probably the number one way to bring somebody to heal other than killing them outright. My assessment is feeding 1.4 billion people is hard on the land that they have and on what they have available. How do they continue to do that in a protracted conflict? Which is why they can't, I think they're mindful that that's tough. That's why there's your point about them stockpiling grain strikes me as more important than just stockpiling oil and energy. But I think both are related. Energy is so profoundly important to modern society. And there, I think, you know, kind of watching oil versus other energy sources. And granted, coal is still one of their key ones. How renewables and other things come to bear. I think that's why the Chinese are so advanced in that. They know that's a vulnerability to a society of their complexity. And again, to the degree that a longer conflict, and this is flipping over to if they were to get in war, they need this to be over quickly before those disruptions hit. But even the Chinese have demonstrated incredible resilience. The starvations and flooding and lack of things in World War II that killed tens of millions of Chinese, and they still persevered, are kind of impressive. And so even if I don't have evidence of strong Chinese military competence in the last 100 years, and there isn't, their resilience is actually still very impressive, but at a cost that it's hard to picture other societies absorbing. They're daunting in every regard, and they're incredible risks too. Just because they persevered in some ways, the perseverance of the nationalists in World War II empowered that you basically paved the way for the communists with Soviet support to take over China after the war. But nonetheless, the Japanese completely misread them. And the Chinese endured incredible hardships that are hard to fathom in any context. But many societies did. But China, I think, really in particular. So I would not rule out their resilience. But it's tough for the government to be the one responsible for that.
No doubt. Maybe we could segue now to maybe talk about the DIME framework a little bit, because at the US-China event, you made a comment that I thought was really interesting in terms of one of the US military's advantages is that we're competent in every sphere of warfare, right? Land, sea, air, and obviously the character of war is changing. We have to consider space and cyber, but you know, our biggest strength being multi-domain expertise. And that's within the M framework of DIME. But maybe to expand this notion of multi-domain expertise, now to recap, DIME stands for diplomatic, informational, military, and economic. And I know that this is one of the frameworks that you guys teach at the War College. Now, my burning question is this, that it seems like we have state machinery in each of these areas in the DIM, except for the E. So in the diplomatic side of things, we've got the State Department. On the informational side of things, we've got the CIA, and obviously the military side are all the armed forces. But it occurs to me that in the economic realm, unless there's a sort of underground structure that I don't know about, it seems like a lot of our economic strategies are beholden to this ephemeral nature of four-year presidential terms. And so when we talk about asymmetric warfare, And you see that China has this autocratic system, for better or for worse. I would say generally it's been for worse, right, from an economic well-being standpoint. But yet in the realm of economic warfare, it seems like they are very cognizant of this vulnerability that we have, that we don't have this machinery behind the E part of dime. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that and perhaps how we can develop an offset strategy there.
You probably haven't figured it out. A lot of my tendencies as kind of an academic and all this is trying to figure out how to win battles and all that. I'm probably a natural contrarian. If somebody makes a statement, I try to figure out what's the counter. Not that I necessarily disagree. I think you've made some fascinating points and I concur with some of them. But if I would just flip over a little bit in terms of, you know, the dime part, and it went from sort of what the government controls to what the society does. If the diplomatic, informational, military, and economic are reflections of instruments of national power, to me, the equation of each of those letters is more than just the U.S. government. Now, granted, for the military, it's overwhelmingly the U.S. government. The military power comes overwhelmingly from the federal government's control of the Department of Defense and all the services. Diplomacy, probably next. You know, we control foreign diplomacy, but frankly, any American operating abroad, including the military or anybody else from the government, is de facto performing diplomacy on behalf of the United States, even if it's just, you know, sort of showing who Americans are in a sense of soft power or whatever. And so you're right in that sort of diplomacy is very heavily controlled foreign diplomacy by the federal government. And on the information side, I would disagree with you a little bit there. I wouldn't have put the CIA at the top. I would have still put the State Department at the top for who conveys the U.S. message or the message of who the U.S. is abroad. What's the information about who we are? But that's also probably, you know, third on my list in terms of what the U.S. government controls. Disney and Netflix and places like that have a lot of influence over what the eye is to the outside world. And those are very American, valuable, soft power sort of influence that the government does not control. And it's one of our strengths. And the last one, probably economics, is probably the one the U.S. government exercises the least direct control over. Yes, we have the Department of Treasury manages money, commerce, managing trade. There's, you know, different entities that are sort of doing how do we manage economics. If I were to think of the most important government contribution to economics, it's our legal system. We have a reliable, predictable legal system that makes transactions in the U.S. economy very well protected. I can trade on my land because I trust property law in the United States. I don't have to live on it to control it and leverage it and invest based on it as a private citizen. Same thing for corporations, all the different folks that represent economic activity. One of the strengths of why do you invest in the United States, why you trust the dollar, is our legal system. It's transparent, predictable, and more trustworthy than most countries in the world, certainly more than the PRC, I would suggest. And so the idea that, yeah, the government doesn't control it directly, but it's the conditions they've set that make it so incredibly valuable. So you're right. So when it comes to how do you use the economy for national purposes, it's harder to pull levers in the U.S. government to make the economy do what the government wants. You can't tell Google, support the military and undermine the Russians or the Chinese. It's hard to make Google or Microsoft or Amazon or anybody do those things directly. But those are all things that are in the United States, partly because of who we were in the first place and the conditions that made them valuable. So I think you're right about the disparity in how we control between the PRC and the United States, those instruments of power at the government level. My sense of the greatest vulnerability is when you're trying to accomplish something in a very short term, how do you bend the United States economic instrument to American national interests? That's hard to do. The government doesn't control them. Same thing with information. The government doesn't control everything. Even the military, we got six branches and each of them tends to have different views of theories of victory. So we tend to argue between the Air Force, Space Force, Marines, Navy, blah, 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 you name it. So we have a fascinating cacophony of actors in some key realms. But the one thing we probably are most inoculated against is one stupid decision by one central authority doing one stupid thing, even though they think it's the right thing.
That's a great point.
Richard, coming back to this lack of a dedicated economic arm of this dime framework, when the Treasury sanctioned the Russian Central Bank after the moves into Ukraine, as a purely economically interested observer of that, that seemed like an incredibly short-sighted decision to me personally, because of the imperatives it then placed upon every other central bank in the world in terms of, we now have a national security issue here that we are beholden to America in terms of if they decide we are a bad actor, we could be in the same position as Russia. Those sort of decisions, you know, if there isn't a dedicated economic arm of this, how do you communicate with the guys making economic decisions from a military standpoint? Because it seems to me that particularly with this free market economy, economic decisions are going to happen in many cases long before military strategic decisions are taken. And those economic decisions, if they're not made in conjunction and in cooperation with the military, could actually become a big problem for the military in later action. So it's kind of a roundabout way of asking the question about that move and whether the military look at that as problematic for them down the track somewhere. And if so, how do we negate that if we don't have access to the economic side of things and any influence over the decisions they're making?
Wow, that's a tough one. As I try to think through that, I mean, several things are going through my head as you were laying that out. There's a part of me thinks that although I have a modest but decent level of formal education in economics, but that I realize simply helped me sort of understand that realm and not command it. And I would hope that as a first principle, that what would the military think about that is, one, we're professionals in sort of the, on the military side. One of the our differences to civilian leadership and our form of government is I'm kind of hopeful that there will be people on in who are more expert in the economic instruments of power at Treasury, at Commerce, in the National Security Council, elsewhere, who can help us gauge those second and third order effects. I wouldn't want to submit those to military judgment alone. First thing you laid out that I was thinking was the problem with any strategy or any tool or instrument you use against another country to try to alter their behavior or achieve as important goals for yourself. Well, there's an interactive dynamic in all of these competitions that once you've used them, and if others perceive a threat from them being used, they may be effective initially, they'll look for counters. So when my first thought was, some of these tools, when you use them, they better be for important reasons because it's unlikely to be as valuable or as useful the next time, because others will look for counters. If we overuse the U.S. dollar as a weapon, they'll find ways to get around the U.S. dollar. And so we should be mindful at all levels of government that strategy about important conflicts, whatever instrument we use, is likely to seek a counter. Now, the other part that I put in terms of depending on how other central banks perceive what we did towards the Russians, I think a lot of this is very context dependent, the sense of can we justify what we did in a way that they'll understand that's because Russia behaved really badly in some other areas that they triggered a U.S. response, Iran, North Korea, others, that they are in a category of folks that hopefully the British, the Australians, and the Indians and others who are not doing sort of nefarious things that would trigger that sort of response would be mindful that one of the things you do is don't trigger legitimate use of American economic power to target you. Don't get on the Americans' bad side. And but a certain legitimacy that goes with, are the Americans using it for laudable, reasonable, whatever adjective you want to put to that purposes? And I think that's where we've got to be careful. And actually, it was the anti-word that was in my head. It's like, don't be capricious about it. It's got to be consistent and justifiable. So if it's just that we're capriciously using central bank power, monetary power, economic power, trade power, then yeah, I'd be more worried than if we're tying it and anchoring it in principles, both for ourselves and for others.
If I could weigh in for just a second on this topic, because the topic of our West Point paper that we presented back in February goes to the heart of this point, to Grant's point. When there is overt weaponization through overuse of sanctions, it actively encourages a seeking out of alternatives. And what the position that we were advocating in our paper is that perhaps relied less on this blunt instrument of sanctions that not only impact China, but could potentially impact other folks, but maybe use more targeted strategies like export control. That's, I think, one thing that we've done successfully in the chip industry is that, you know, we are attacking China's reliance on the supply chain with targeted export controls, where those controls really only impact China, but not anybody else. I think that's a better strategy than using, for instance, the blunt instrument of financial sanctions that impacts everybody within the dollar system. But then the other observation I would say also is that where an economic force or an economic department might come in handy is just looking at what we're doing on the oil space, right? We might be doing some of the right things in semiconductors, but I think we're doing the wrong thing in terms of energy security by gutting our SPDR, for instance. And then one last thought I wanted to say is that the point you made about context is very important, because I would say that in general, even despite this overuse of sanctions against these hostile actions, the US, I would say, has been a pretty benign superpower. And our actions tend to be always held at a much higher standard, deservedly so, given our predominant role in the world. Again, I want to point to something that Kyle Bass recently said in his speech at the Hudson Institute. People think about, oh, okay, there's always a greener pasture somewhere else, but is there? Because he pointed out that, for instance, China on the economic front has been basically intentionally defaulting on onshore dollar bonds. So out of about 170 billion of US dollar denominated bonds, what he found that was very interesting to me was that 65% of these bonds that are dollar denominated are in default, as opposed to 21% of the onshore bonds of the same company. So China has also played its sanctions game too. So I would just caution to the folks who are always looking for the greener pasture to the dollar that greener pasture might not necessarily exist relative to the US dollar.
Yeah, I think the problem is when you talk about greener pastures, at the moment, it's really a case of, well, we need an alternative. We literally cannot afford to be hostage to, as Richard, you know, capriciousness is the perfect word for this. But we can't even take a chance that there will be capricious, because this is our national treasure chest. You know, we cannot have our reserves under someone else's de facto control. It's just not an option. So, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of, as you say, Michael, attempts to find greener pastures, but those greener pastures might be just a diversification of all kinds of different alternatives, whether it's cutting down on the number of reserves you have, whether it's stocking up on raw materials instead of holding them in cash form. I don't know, but that one move really placed that imperative on every central bank in the world to at least think through, okay, as Richard and his colleagues have to have a plan for eventualities, this is an eventuality you have to sit down and think through and have a strategy to deal with. I think that's the difference here. It wasn't something you needed to worry about up until, you know, February 2022. I'm curious about the eye and the dime, the informational thing. We talked a little bit about that. And the State Department, the CIA on the government / public side of this. On the other side, you talked about Disney. We talked about the media side and Hollywood. I'm a big movie buff and I love to go to the movies. And it's been fascinating to watch the beginning of so many films and see how many Chinese production companies, Hong Kong production companies are now in Hollywood. And it strikes me that as much as the Disneys, the Netflixes of the world are in a position to project American values and project all the things that help that informational side of the dime framework, there's been a very noticeable move, whether it's a state-level move to extend Chinese influence into Hollywood. We've seen it in things as small as how when Top Gun Maverick, they made him take the Taiwan badge off the flight jacket because otherwise they wouldn't show the movie in China. From very small things like that to an influence being made to make no more Chinese. Like in the 80s, all the bad guys were Russian. In the 90s, 2000s, all the bad guys were Chinese. And there's been a noticeable deceleration in that. So I'm curious as to how you think about Hollywood and the influence in Hollywood as a potential threat of some kind.
Hollywood is a threat. I guess I haven't really thought of them that way. As a powerful element of American informational influence around the world, it's sort of a, this is who Americans are. But it's not a perfect representation. It's been flawed in many ways in terms of who's represented on screen. Minorities have been underrepresented, women. So there's a lot of ways that Hollywood reflects some of our less stellar elements. But it's still kind of open, and it's not just Hollywood. My sense is that media nowadays, I mentioned Netflix was kind of the other one. I read a fascinating article about how Netflix is global and how we ended up with Squid Game and things like that, which had to do with the sensitivity to what worked in Korea that might resonate more broadly. That wasn't government control. The power of some of these dynamics to show kind of who we are, warts and all, is something that I think it's really hard. Because I watch a lot of Chinese movies. I'm watching one right now, which is the highest grossing movie in Chinese history, because I'm going to show it in a strategic arts, or what we call the strategic arts film program. It's the Battle of Lake Changjin, which is to Americans and British, the Battle of Kyosan Reservoir. The most highest grossing movie. It's a ponderous 3-hour monstrosity that has all the propaganda links in it. I can see why it appeals to Chinese. It got very little non-Chinese box office, but kind of watching how these things play out. And that's something where I'm less concerned about what Hollywood can do. I'm kind of happy for them to kind of be out there and be a market force. And my sense is, and by the way, that the Top Gun, the Taiwan flag stayed on his jacket. I think they removed it from a trailer. There was like a brief step of, oh my God. I think for that reason, the Chinese did not screen it. So that it has not gone to the PRC because he left it on there. If I recall correctly, the final version of the movie, it's on there. So that was a case of potential cowardice that didn't happen. But nonetheless, self-censorship, not to offend the Chinese in a big market, I think is out there. But it's sort of, there's a lot of market forces that sort of drive that. I'm less concerned their ability to equilibrate and go back and forth and counterpoint and for us to be able to discuss that and put the counter pressures on them, I think is a virtue of a Western approach to media being privatized heavily with a government voice that can say, hey, that's not helpful. But Hollywood is a threat. I guess that was, I never really thought of Hollywood as a threat. They've been a major asset more than anything else to me.
I want to watch that movie now. I've not heard of that movie.
The Battle of Lake Changjin. Yeah, I'd heard about it. I was reading about it a short while ago. I think it got 1 star from the person who reviewed it. But they talked exactly about what you said, Richard, about how it was just a wildly propagandistic piece of filmmaking.
It is an optional thing. It's not a required thing for our students. Usually I've used Wolf Warrior 2, which has all the same themes, but a more cheesy. If you've ever seen Wolf Warrior 2 and you're talking about Wolf Warrior diplomacy, that's what they're referring to. Not Wolf Warrior 1, but Wolf Warrior 2, which is a little sillier, a lot more racist, frankly, towards Africans, because it's sort of, anyway, if you've ever seen Wolf Warrior 2, this was kind of meant to, okay, the same basic themes. And by the way, the star of the movie is the same star from the Wolf Warrior movies, Wu Jin.
Okay. Okay. I need to dig this out. I need to find Wolf Warrior 2.
So yeah, Wolf Warrior 1 and 2. 1's okay. It's basically a PLA propaganda film. Wolf Warrior 2 is a little more of the jingoistic nationalist thing, ending with a Chinese propaganda thing right at the end. If you're a Chinese citizen abroad, you will be protected. It's literally a passport cover of a PRC citizen at the end of the movie that they voice over. Anyway.
I got one last question for you, Richard. And this is how I closed out our last interview, which is, do you think it's possible for us to have an Asian NATO?
Oh, this is one of these perennial questions. All the military folks like me will tell you, yes, we prefer an Asian NATO. Everybody brings that up. I can't tell you how many students, you know, who have cycled through the War College and want to do their paper on how to build an Asian NATO. In principle, I agree wholeheartedly. Having been chief of plans in Korea and understood how vital the Japanese-Korean relationship is, how we think about security in Northeast Asia, in principle, a NATO for Asia would probably be valuable. I find it positive and probably the best we're going to do that a lot of those same countries all participate in NATO. If you notice the NATO summit, most of those countries have some, I forget the title of their affiliation, with NATO. So the Japanese, Koreans, the Australians, and some others have, you know, tend to participate with NATO in terms of coordinating. So at some level, it would be nice if they did that. I understand, particularly the Japanese-Korean dynamics that make it difficult for that to actually occur in, you know, de jure. But I would hope that we'll get past some of their historical baggage to where they can be like the Germans and the French in Europe, that they can be in the same organization as equals. But the way World War II and the post-World War II thing played out in Asia, we didn't really put a lot of effort in to try to, the United States, but neither did the two countries, try to reconcile the incredibly difficult baggage and very different than Germany and France, that the dynamic between Japan as colonial power that abused Korea makes that one a real hard lift. In a similar fashion, I don't know about Australia and the New Zealand and all these, but my sense is those would probably be easier to reconcile than the core one.
Well, we managed to pull France and Germany together.
Well, this is true. I think they pulled themselves together more than we did. I mean, we had a lot to do with it. And the way World War II played out in Europe, I mean, each context is a little bit different. But remember, the coal steel community, that was France and Germany. We didn't do that. We did NATO. But they kind of reconciled the economic part on their own, or at least they took the lead in that part, crudely. I'm not sure, even though you would think there could be a similar dynamic, One of my greatest surprises when I got to Korea, because I had the same view. It's like, hey, Japan, Korea, United States, we're all friends. We're all allies. I'm sure we could all get together. I was not ready for the vitriol.
Yeah.
Adjectives before Japan in Korea. And it's funny, I'm a student of the Korean War fighting the Chinese. I just assumed the Koreans would hate the Chinese because we fought a major war with them in 1950. The adjectives that went for the Chinese are much more benign than the adjectives that go with the Japanese if you ever go to Korea. And that part took me a while to wrap my head around how visceral the cultural baggage was and the hatred toward the Japanese, some of which reflected on us. The base where I worked had been the Japanese imperial headquarters during the colonization period. And of course, it was good that the Americans, when we found a place, we took over what the Japanese army gave up. But the Koreans would routinely point out to us, this is in downtown Seoul, you know, Yongsan, as it's called. They would point out, those are the old Japanese army headquarters from the 20s. And there was still a little bit of baggage that we occupied the Japanese Imperial Army headquarters for 8th Army and U.S. Forces Korea, which we finally gave back a couple of years ago. And again, it was sort of a friendly point, but they would kind of note, this place has been occupied by foreigners for 100 years. And the first 40 were Japanese, and it was bad. And we like you better than the Japanese, but there's some baggage to taking over real estate in downtown Seoul.
Yeah. Well, Richard, thank you so much for giving up so much of your time.
I wasn't
expecting that we'd also get a film review out of this, which is even better. That's a real pleasant surprise. So thank you again for giving up the time and for giving us a window into a world that is so fascinating to those of us outside it and so important for us to try and get a better understanding of. So I really appreciate your efforts in trying to help us do that.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Grant, it was a pleasure to meet you and talk with you. And Michael, as always, it's been it's been fascinating to get to know you and have these conversations, which really are, I mean, I'm talking about things I hadn't quite thought of the same way for all the good reasons that I love the academic world, you know, being challenged by somebody that, why do you do this? Huh? I don't know.
But I mean, this is such a cool platform for me and Grant, I think, because I think we're bringing, you know, specialists and heavyweights like you to an audience that normally doesn't really get a glimpse inside, and really, really thank you.
I wouldn't count myself as a heavyweight, but I enjoy these topics immensely. And an academic heart to me, it probably goes back to living in Europe for 6 years when I was a kid. That just sort of, so I one of the questions some people have asked me is like, well, so what state are you from? It's like, I don't have a state.
Right.
That's not normal for an American.
No, it's not.
So I realized I am not a typical American. I realized that a long time ago that I don't have a state or local identity. I'm an Army brat who really kind of has a American crudely as the umbrella, military as a subset, which I realize makes me doubly not a normal American. A state identity and kind of a non-American local identity, it's the military community, which is, so I kind of know I'm a weirdo.
You're an American.
Yeah. You're an American.
But my country puts up with me.
Very cool.
There you go.
It's been a great
person. Very cool.
Fantastic. Richard, thank you again. Really, really appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Boy, it's fascinating. It's such a window into a world. I don't understand, and I know I need to understand it better. So I'm so glad that you're able to get these guys to come and talk with us, because it's invaluable. I'm left thinking about so many things and trying to understand so many things, and my questions will get better as we go through the series, but it's just such a great window.
I guess that's a sign of a good podcast, where like the answers just prompt more questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully.
exactly. Well, Matey, listen, we will be back and do this again soon, I hope. Just before we disappear, let all the folks out there listening know where they can read more of your work, because it's just so thought-provoking.
I'm at urbancowboy.com, and I'm on Twitter, and really looking forward to the next episode.
Amen, my friend. All right, let's do it again soon.
Take care.
Thanks, Mike. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.